History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that really should not go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a whole lot, don't we? We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Las Vegas, Nevada, with a gentleman who's about to turn 93, but went through quite an experience as a teenager during World War II. Jerry Deitch is our guest today. Been in Las Vegas for the last quarter century. He still is a volunteer with the police department here. We'll talk about that. But let's go way back, Jerry, to Brooklyn, New York, as a child. What are those earliest memories you have of the Big Apple in the 20s and 30s?
Well, I have a lot of memories because it was a time that depression was started. And we had very little. What we did have a lot of was food. And reason for that is my father was a master chef. And in lieu of pay, he got mostly good steaks and very good food. So we never lacked food. As a matter of fact, I used to have friends and neighbors come in. My father, but it got a half a salary, half in food and half in very little salary. But that was the times. Nobody had anything. So I wasn't jealous of anybody. Everybody around me didn't have anything.
And you were one of four children growing up in that family in Brooklyn. You mentioned your father being a master chef. Where was he a chef? Was it a restaurant
was,
there?
He was in a restaurant. At one time he was in Waldorf Astoria in the banquet room. He was a chef there. But most of all, he was one of the first union members. And wherever there was an opening at a restaurant, he got in there. The most I remember was one particular restaurant. He was there about 10 years, and he got half salary and the other half in food. I like the other half in food.
Yeah, it came in real handy during the Great Depression, I'm sure. And I know at this age, you would have never heard of a Navy SEAL. No one had. They didn't exist yet. But you would be part of the predecessors to the SEALs eventually. I'm wondering when you were that boy, and you had an older brother and an older sister and a little brother, what were the things you dreamt about that you said, hey, when I grow up, here's what Jerry's going to do?
You know, when I was a little boy and I was a reader, and I said I would like to be an engineer and like to make drafts of big skyscrapers. And I used to dream about that. Mm-hmm. I said, one day I have to be an engineer. And that, of course, disappeared. When I joined the military, I had thoughts of making that my career, a military. Then I was hurt and had the headache problem, which I had for a long time. A lot of good memories and a lot of bad memories. The bad memories of guys that I worked with for, you know, so many months that just didn't make it. And that sort of stayed with me a long time. I never spoke to my family about experiences because I for a couple of years after I got out of the military, I had nightmares. I don't think a year went by where I didn't have a half a dozen nightmares. But I spoke to a doctor about it, and he says, that's the usual thing. You know, it's going to happen. Eventually, it'll disappear. I'll tell you, it never disappears every June 6th. I still have nightmares.
We're going to talk about June 6th. And this June 6th, on the 75th anniversary of the Normandy invasion, you're going to be part of a very special ceremony. We'll talk about that, too. But while I'm thinking about you as that boy growing up in Brooklyn, I'm just wondering, maybe it's just me, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm into baseball, and I think being a kid in New York in the 30s had to be the best for a baseball fan.
I was a Yankee fan. I was a diehard Yankee fan, and when I went into the service, I became a Brooklyn Dodger fan, but I still got the Yankees at heart.
Well, and then you had the Yankees, you had the Dodgers, you had the Giants right there in New York City.
Yeah, I had the Giants in football, but I didn't. They were my enemies in baseball.
And were you ever at the house that Ruth built, watching him play?
I went there. I never watched him play, no. Mm-hmm. Saw photos of him, news reports of him, that's it.
Listen to the games on the radio?
Always, always. And my son says to me, did you enjoy it listening to the radio? I said, the same as if I was there. You just, your mind works differently. You just hear it and you think you're there.
So you're growing up and December 7th, 1941. Seems like everybody who was alive remembers something about that day.
I know exactly what I was doing. I was listening to, at that time, the Brooklyn Dodgers had a football team and the New York Giants before the National Football League came in. And I was listening to the game and they interrupted the game and said Pearl Harbor was attacked. I didn't know where Pearl Harbor was or what Pearl Harbor was, but I knew that we were attacked. That was it. The next day, I was on the fencing team in high school and I watched the basketball team, the seniors, all left school and went to volunteer. And that's when it really hit me.
And you were too young to go in then, but did it cross your mind?
I was 15 years old, and I'll tell you a story. I went with the basketball team to volunteer, and they said hello and goodbye.
You couldn't pass for old enough, huh?
Oh, I was 15 and probably looked like I was 13.
Well, and even younger than that, there was a significant moment in your life. When you were 11, you met someone special and you told her that you thought you two should get married. Do I have that straight?
Yeah, you have that straight. I didn't tell her. I told it to her mother.
Well, we've got to hear that story. How did you two first meet?
Well, I became a Boy Scout when I was 11 years old, and I met her cousin who lived next door to her, and we became good buddies. He invited me over to his house one time, and that's how I met my wife, Selma. And I knew right away. She didn't. We were just friends. But I became so close to her family. She was the only child, but I called her mother Aunt Minnie, and she referred to me as nephew. And then I said one day after a couple of months of knowing her, I says, I'm going to marry your daughter one day. And she said, and when would that be? And I hardly remember that, but she always brought it up to me. I said, when I'm 40 years old.
Well, you didn't wait that long, did you?
No, when I was 20 years old, I was in on leave, and I said to her, will you marry me? She said, let me think about it. And then I went over to her mother, and she said, it's up to Selma. And she finally came around to it about 3 months later.
And meanwhile, all these other things are going on. So you say, you know, when Pearl Harbor happened, you tried to sign up then. You weren't old enough yet. As you got closer and closer to 18, and you thought about the prospect of the draft and the government deciding where you were going to go in this war effort, what was the decision you ended up making?
Well, I knew one sure I didn't want to go into the Army. I wanted to go into the Navy, but I wasn't the best kind of sailor. I got seasick on rowboats or on a ferry. So I went ahead, and I heard about Special Forces, and I volunteered for that, but I had to take some hard exams, and I aced them all, and they took me in after 5 weeks. I finished boot camp early, and 3 weeks later, a week after my 18th birthday, I was on the Queen Mary on my way to Scotland. And 4 days later, I was in Scotland.
How did your parents feel about your decision to do that and what you volunteered for?
Well, they weren't too happy because my older brother was already drafted. He was in, and they said, can't you wait a while? And I said, no, because now I have the chance to pick out the service that I want. Otherwise, they're going to choose what they think is the proper thing for me. And they finally, well, my father acquiesced. My mother wasn't too happy.
And you said something there, you know, that you volunteered for Special Forces. Now, I've had so many veterans over the years, hundreds of them tell me the first rule of the military is you never volunteer for anything.
I promised my older brother when I said, speak to Mom and Dad. And I wrote him letters because he's already overseas. And I said, speak to Mom and Dad and tell them to let me go into the service. He says, Jerry, make one promise to me that you'll never volunteer. And I said, word of honor, we'll never volunteer. When they called for volunteers, I was the first one to raise my hand.
And did you have any idea what you were volunteering for?
Absolutely not. I knew that the Seabees were involved because they were training us in demolitions. And I always thought of construction, that's going to be my thing. I'm going to be an engineer. So I thought very little of it. I just the fact that they were Seabees, construction battalion, I went in. I did not know anything about it.
If you had known then what you know now, do you think you would have volunteered?
Absolutely. It became in my blood very fast.
Well, and you became part of something that's called an NCDU, and a lot of people maybe have never heard of that.
Naval Combat Demolition Unit was something new. You work with engineers, Army engineers. They were much older than us because they were Seabees. So they went in prior to the war. So we trained with them on all kinds of explosives and reconnaissance work. Most of them were old enough to be my father.
Well, you say you train with explosives and reconnaissance work. When I think of training with explosives, sounds kind of dangerous. I mean, there are a lot of things that can go wrong. Sometimes you learn the lesson by blowing off an extremity or losing your life.
Yeah, but I got to tell you, we got great, great, great training. And any time that we were going to let explosives go, we yelled down the line, "Fire in the hole, fire in the hole." And that went right down the line. Everybody jumped out of the way. We were trained safety first. Look around before you let an explosive go. Before you pull the pin, make sure you haven't anybody. And we worked in two buddies, two men at a time. Make sure you covered him and he covered you.
And you gave us a sense of how quickly you were rushed into action after you volunteered and how quickly you headed overseas. You mentioned you turned 18 in April of 1944, a couple months before the Normandy invasion. How much did you know ahead of time about what you guys were going to be doing?
Well, we trained for it. We did train for it. We trained in England, and we trained constantly. We trained day and night. We trained how the landing's going to take place. We knew everything, except where we were going. We had no idea where we were going. Then we went to a marshalling area, which was 48 hours before we boarded ships to go.
Well, and I'm just thinking back something you said. You said when you went into the Navy, you realized that you could get seasick on a rowboat and that you needed to do something other than be a sailor. So what about that journey across the Atlantic? Did you get seasick there?
Nobody got seasick on the Queen. Yeah, a couple of people did on the Queen Mary, but that was such a great ship. As a matter of fact, I got a simple story that I tell my family. I was sitting on a promenade deck, and there was a Protestant minister sitting right next to me, and he introduced himself to me, and I gave him my name, and he said, "Do you realize that when this ship was civilian ship, to be on a promenade deck, it would cost you a year's salary, and here you are sitting here on a promenade deck." I got to tell you, it was 5 days of, I will say one thing, because of so many troops on there, I ate at 6 o'clock in the morning breakfast and at 3 o'clock dinner. And I got to tell you, 8 o'clock at night, I was starving.
Yeah,
well, they couldn't feed everybody. You know, they had to do it. They had to do it that way. But it was 5 days. The ship was fast. They didn't have to zigzag. They just went straight across 4.5 days, New York to Scotland.
What about that time before the invasion? Are there some memories that stand out for you? Because you're a long way from home. I mean, and the United Kingdom is a big difference from New York City. Are there some things that happened or some things that stand out in your memories?
Yeah, I got to tell you that when we started the invasion, we went in on the first wave, I was sure that I was not going to see my family again. I saw bodies floating all around me, and you're oblivious of it. You really, maybe because you say, "Thank God it's not me," but you don't, you just look right past it. It didn't, it was never happening. Was I in shock? I possibly was. Possibly was, and I think everybody else was.
Well, and let me rewind just a little bit to when you said that, you know, 48 hours ahead of time, you find out this is happening now. You probably have no idea how big this is going to be, how many other people are involved. But what did you understand your mission or assignment or role to be before you went across the channel?
We knew right away that we were going to go in first. And if there were any obstacles that would be in the way of the first wave coming in behind us, that we would take care of that. We would make room for them to land. And in most cases, they couldn't. They stopped their boats in about 4 feet of water. Many of them may have drowned because they had all the gear on them, and they may have drowned because they couldn't. They just couldn't get ashore.
So a few questions come to mind just to try to fill in the blanks for people listening here. This is NCDU 30, Naval Combat Demolition Unit 30. You guys had 100 men in that unit?
I don't recall whether it was 50 at Utah Beach and 50 at Omaha Beach, or was it 100 and 100? It seems to me 50 and 50. But Omaha Beach was tough. They ran against cliffs, and the Germans were above, just throwing everything at them down the cliffs. They really took a beating.
Jerry's thankfully came ashore at Utah Beach, not Omaha Beach. But where he was wasn't exactly safe either, and he would learn that firsthand. When I first met Jerry Deitch in Las Vegas, he told me that on June 6th, 1944, 8 hours felt like 28 hours. Find out why when we come back. And for photos and video related to Jerry's story, head over to the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook or to hometownheroesradio.com. We'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with Jerry Deitch, 92 years old, of Las Vegas, Nevada, where for the better part of 15 years he's volunteered with the police department. He'll tell us exactly what he does for them a little later. He and his wife of 71 years, Selma, have made Vegas their home for the last quarter century. But they never would have gotten married. Their 2 children, 4 grandchildren, and 8 great-grandchildren would have never been born if he didn't make it through the longest day, D-Day, June 6th, 1944. He came ashore that day on Utah Beach as part of NCDU 30, that's Naval Combat Demolition Unit.
We came in on regular landing crafts, you know. We got off LSDs and we got on smaller boats.
Like LCVPs or rubber boats?
Yeah. Not rubber boats, no. LCV. It was cold. It was cold. And it was rough. The weather was rough. As a matter of fact, I remember, and it's going to be in my mind for years to come, going down the ropes. The boats were coming up because of the waves, coming up and then dropping maybe 25 feet, coming up and dropping. And the guys that were there before me down in the boats saying, not yet, not yet, leave go and drop. And they were ready to catch you if the boat was going down. I had 2 guys catch me, you know. Because of all the gear that I had on me.
Yeah, what were you carrying?
I was carrying a knapsack. I was carrying a rifle. I was carrying a mess kit. And, of course, I had heavy combat boots and a heavy uniform on. And I know that on my back, that was 30 pounds that I was carrying.
And you're not the biggest guy in the world.
I was the shortest one in the unit. Everybody was between 5'10 and 6'4.
And you're 5'7?
5'7.
And you carrying explosives?
No, what we did was we unloaded the boat. It was just, there were 3 rookies, myself and 2 others, and they left us to carry all the explosives ashore. Well, out of, I think there were 4 of us. Out of the 4, 2 ran, and I and another guy, we carried them ashore and came back, carried them ashore, and we were in 2 foot of water. Of course, it couldn't land all the way.
So this is Utah Beach on June 6, 1944. And what's happening around you? That's what you're doing. But what are you seeing? What are you hearing?
I saw a tank come on just before us. One tank. And I saw people huddling behind the tank, not realizing that we're taking cover. I went ahead and got up to the tank and put my hands out. Like, it was cold. and I thought they were warming themselves. No. And somebody behind me says, keep low, because German 88s were pounding the beach. As the tide was coming in, they were coming closer and closer.
And you saw American servicemen who'd already been killed.
Yeah, had already been killed and getting killed. And the guy next to me in my outfit was killed immediately. He didn't even know what hit him.
How far away was he from you?
Oh, I would say 2 feet. Maybe less than that. He was almost standing next to me.
So how did you experience that?
I don't know. I right now and afterwards, I think I was in shock. I didn't think about it. I thought, going through my mind, this is what I have to do. This is what I have to do. This is the way I have to set up the explosives. This is what I'm looking for.
But you're there, and he's next to you, and then a moment later, he's gone?
Yeah. And you want to know something? It didn't hit me. It didn't hit me. When I got to the hospital 3 days later, that's when it hit me. It hit me that all these guys that I trained with were gone. Soldiers that I didn't know, that they had to be not much older than me.
And you're just 18, yeah. And you mentioned unloading all the explosives and the supplies for your unit. What about the rest of that day? Because it's been famously called the longest day. What were you doing the rest of June 6th, okay. And how long for you?
We were busy clearing up the beaches with obstacles that were in the way of the guys coming down. We did that without even thinking, and we cleared everything away. Then we had a pillbox that was about, I would say, a quarter of a mile from where we were, and maybe it was a little less than that. And we went ahead and put explosives around there. We didn't see anybody. And then we ducked back about 100 yards back, and we saw them coming out, Germans coming out with their hands raised, surrendering. We don't know how many were killed.
So did you blow the pillbox or no?
We blew it. Yeah, we gave ourselves 10 minutes and we blew it. 10 minutes to get out of the way, get the hell out of the way.
So it was after you detonated the explosives that they came running out?
Yeah, they came running out. How many were in there? How many were killed? I don't know. But they came out and my commanding officer took prisoners and turned them over to the infantry right away. I don't know how many.
And before that, when you said, you know, for the next several hours you were clearing obstructions on the beach, does that mean you're setting explosives on those obstructions?
Explosives, yeah. They were obstacles in the way, yeah.
Like those famous tank obstructions we see?
Yeah, and telemines. There was mines on posts.
This is pretty dangerous work, Jerry.
Yeah, but I was pretty young, 18 guys. You know, 18-year-old is indestructible.
But you're surrounded by chaos, by death, by destruction. And none of that slowed you down or fazed you or gave you pause?
No, you know when it bothered me? When I was in a hospital for 3 nights. I slept the first night. I was dead tired. But after that, I was up most of the night. On my mind was, I'm never going to see my family again. And I'm not going to see my buddies again that I went through boot camp and volunteered with. I couldn't get that out of my mind.
Well, and you mentioned a couple times being in the hospital. I'm sure people are saying, hospital? Well, what put them in the hospital? What happened? Tell us a story. What is that story? What happened?
Okay, what happened was, I don't want to blame it on somebody, but somebody in my outfit, we dug foxholes. And somebody in my outfit, when they started bombardment, they had 88s miles away that were beltering the beach. Someone went into the foxhole that I made. And I looked, and I wasn't going to jump on him. And I just went ahead about 5-6 feet. And all of a sudden, there was an explosion. And I heard a bang on my helmet. And then I went down, and I had a concussion.
Did it knock you unconscious?
Dazed, because I didn't want to go. I said, I'm not going. And my commanding officer says, you are going. I know the medic stuck a flashlight in front of my eyes, and obviously he didn't like what he saw, and he says, you are going.
Well, I don't want to be melodramatic, but I'm just thinking about that moment. And you don't know how big a piece of shrapnel hit you, but
I don't know what hit me. My commanding officer said it was shrapnel all over the place.
Well, and I guess it hit you in the right spot, right?
Yeah, all I had was a big dent on my helmet, and it took a lot to dent that helmet.
And if you didn't have the helmet, it would have killed you.
I would have been dead.
Well, and even if you had the helmet, but that was a few inches lower?
I don't know what would have happened. I would have been knocked out for sure. Here I was in a daze. Then when I got on a ship to take me to the, it was an English hospital that taken over by the United States Army, they said I slept for 12 hours.
And you said that was the time when you're sitting in that hospital that your mind started to comprehend some of what you'd been doing?
Yeah, I knew right then and there that I said, I'm not going to see my family again. I'm not going to see my buddies again.
But you chose to rejoin your buddies when they told you you don't have to. Tell me what happened there.
They told me, they said, we could put you on a hospital ship and you go back to the United States. And I said, no, I know that we were preparing. We didn't know where. We didn't know where we were preparing for another landing. I says, they're going to leave for Italy and train there. So I want to be there when they leave for Italy.
So you were gone from the unit for how long?
I was in the hospital for 8 days.
Was anybody surprised to see you when you came back?
My commanding officer said, I was in an Army uniform. They took my fatigues away. The only thing that left me was with combat boots. And they burnt everything else. So they gave me an Army uniform, which was 10 sizes too big for the little guy I was. And the nurses went ahead and pinned it up for me and did everything. The blouse came down to my knees. And then they gave me free tickets on a train to go to Plymouth, Southern England. I got on that train, and this I remember vividly. The people were buying sandwiches and tea, which was the English drink. Two Englishmen came over to me, and they said, here are sandwiches on us. And at that time, I had tears in my eyes, and I wasn't that kind of guy. Rarely did I get tears in my eyes.
Well, it shows you what it meant to them that so many Americans were over there trying to save their homeland. And so you got back to your unit, and you looked a little funny compared to what they were wearing?
Yeah, walked in, and my commanding officer says, hey, Deitch, what are you doing, joining the Army? I said, does it look like it? I said, I don't even fit with this.
So what happened from there? You had another invasion to make?
Yeah, so from there, you know, they outfitted me with more combat stuff, and they had to give me a rifle and all. And we got on a ship, a troop ship, and we went to Naples, Italy. And from there, we got on trucks, and we went to Salerno, Italy. And there they set up a training base. And the weather there was the kind of weather that you have in southern France. So that's where they wanted us to train. We trained there for about 6 weeks.
And what was different about that invasion, southern France?
It was a piece of cake. It was great. We came in with our combat stuff and all, and we've had people greeting us, and they said, the Germans left yesterday.
A lot better than 88's shelling you, huh?
Yeah, there was nothing there. They came with flowers, they came with food, they came with everything. As far as I was concerned, it was not an invasion, although I got a combat medal for it.
Well, and while all this is going on, there's plenty going on in the Pacific as well. And there would be underwater demolition teams that would learn lessons, like at Tarawa, where they had a problem with the coral reef. So then later on, they would blow up the reefs. And you ended up kind of migrating to a UDT as well?
What happened was I got on a 30-day survivor's leave. I went home for 30 days. And then I had to report to Fort Pierce, Florida. And there, I picked whatever I wanted. Whatever I wanted to go on a ship, I said, no ship. I saw them training this underwater demolition team. I'm not the greatest swimmer. I said, we'll teach you. And my commanding officer came over and knew me. He says, I'm running the unit. I want you to come with us. And I'll tell you off the record, we're going to hit another part of France, but we're going to train for it. And we did. Great group of guys.
Well, and I've got to ask you, too, you said something there that may have kind of snuck by people, but you said 30 days survivor's leave.
Yeah.
They give survivor's leave to people who were in a very severe situation where a lot of their buddies were killed.
Yeah. I came home, and when I was home for 30 days, there were at least 5 days I didn't sleep. I kept replaying everything that happened to me over there.
And you mentioned something earlier about headaches. Was that a result of that concussion at Utah Beach?
You know, I would imagine it was. And that didn't last for long.
So Fort Pierce, Florida, underwater demolition teams. And this is the beginning stages of what would become the Navy SEALs program that we know today. What was the most challenging aspect of what you did there?
You know, we were treated with a lot of respect because we were combat veterans and we got a lot of respect. They didn't teach me anything I didn't know. I knew everything. The only part that I had to learn and really work at it is swimming. We had it every day. We ran a mile on the beach early in the morning, and then we got into the water, and we had to swim 1 mile out and 1 mile in, 2 miles every morning. And we had to do it within 45 minutes. And I did it in an hour and a half because I was stopping every 10 minutes, lying on my back and resting. I was not the greatest swimmer in the world, but I made it.
Well, I was going to say, they even gave you the responsibility of leading an underwater demolition team?
I was an assistant leader, but I was a great explosive man. And eventually, with the proper gear, because we did it without gear, then they gave us swim fins, masks, and you swam a lot easier.
Well, and that's one of the things that I've seen a lot of people react to over the years. When I've interviewed guys who were frogmen in World War II, there's quite a contrast between the equipment that a Navy SEAL has access to today and what you guys were outfitted with.
What we had access to was air tanks, and if you didn't quit that air tank at a certain amount of time, you could die. Not now. I had one guy, I didn't know him that well, but he was an instructor, and he had a tank on, and he stayed 10 minutes longer than he should have, never came out of it. He just got married a week before, and not in combat. This was just a training exercise.
When you guys are training there and you're preparing to go to the Pacific?
Yeah, we trained there specifically to go to Pacific, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when did you head out and where'd you go?
I headed out just prior to the invasion of Iwo Jima, but we stood by. They had enough of our guys going in there. As far as I was concerned, it was a piece of cake because we didn't go ashore.
And did you continue to have those feelings you had talked about of I might not ever make it back? That girl Selma, who I told her I'd love to marry her, I may not see her again?
Yeah, that stayed with me for at least a year. And then I got back in my mind saying to my mother and father when I left, I'm indestructible. But for a long time, that was out of my mind.
There's more to Jerry's World War II story, and we'll explore that when we come back. From NCDU to a different acronym, UDT, that really would pave the way for four letters that have become synonymous with Navy Special Warfare and the best of the best. Those four letters, of course, SEAL, for sea, air, and land. But before the Navy SEALs, there were underwater demolition teams, and we'll learn about Jerry Deitch's role in one of those when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Jerry Deitch of Las Vegas, Nevada, originally from Brooklyn, New York. On June 6, 1944, he came ashore at Utah Beach with Naval Combat Demolition Unit 30. His helmet would save his life when a piece of shrapnel sent him to the ground, but merely dented that metal on his head. After returning from Europe, he trained with Underwater Demolition Team 24, and he was one of those UDT-24 frogmen who left Maui in July 1945, headed for Japan.
What happened was we were getting ready to invade. We were getting to invade, and all of a sudden, we got it on the radio that MacArthur was on his way to Japan to sign a peace treaty. So we kept going, and we went to Hokkaido, which is northern part of Japan, which I mentioned before, 85 miles south of Vladivostok, Russia. It was summertime, but it was freezing because we were so far close to Siberia. And we went in. There were two of us that went in. With no guns. We just had a knife on us. And we went in with a rubber boat to see if there were roads that where they led, if they led across the island. So he went looking there, and I stayed on the beach, and I saw this tall Japanese guy. And the reason he's tall, I found out later on, was because the Russians came down from Siberia, and they were playing around. Mm-hmm. And they were tall, tall Japanese. He was tall, and I was trying to motion and make friends. I went and made like an airplane, and he showed me, he pointed, and there was a bomber that was shot down on the first raid to Tokyo. So I don't know what happened. I never saw a tall one before, and he had a big
sickle or something?
Yeah, something like that. And he was holding it in his hand. Now, I was of no danger. I didn't have, and my buddy was looking for a road. So I said, arigato. I said the few words that they told us in Japanese. And when I said arigato to him, and I bowed down, so he smiled at me. But I didn't know what I was going to do. All I had was a knife, and he held it up like this. And he bowed back down to me. And that was it. Then my buddy came back, and we got what we wanted to know. We drew a drawing of the beach and how it was, and we left there. I never got back to Hokkaido again. However, I'm missing a very important point. When my team came ashore in Hokkaido, they found a barge loaded with ammunition. So they hooked it onto one of the boats, and my executive officer got in the boat that was going to tow it out to sea. He got in, and we, with our rubber boat, we were about 100 yards behind him, and he was taking it back, and all of a sudden there was a big explosion. He was helicoptered out. I don't know what happened to him. Barely injured. Now, you would know the name. He was Otto Graham's brother. You remember Otto Graham, the football player?
Yeah, quarterback of the Cleveland Browns.
Yeah, he was his brother. At that time, he was in college.
What ended up happening to him?
Badly hurt. I don't know. We never got any news. Helicoptered him into a hospital someplace.
So this is after your reconnaissance mission, after you'd scouted it out, so your unit comes ashore and they find this Japanese ammunition. Do you think it was booby-trapped? Is that why it went off?
It had to be.
And how long did you stay there?
We stayed there 2 days.
And was that
it? We know that our exec was taken to a hospital. That's all.
And did you get to come home after that?
2 months later.
Well, given those thoughts you'd had of, I'm never going to see my family again, I'm never going to see my friends again, what was it like to finally come back to the States?
Well, first of all, as soon as the war ended, you know, we knew it was over. That's it. You know, great, I'm going back, I'm going home, you know.
Do you remember what it was like to come back home?
I was in a happy shock.
So you had floated that idea of marrying Selma when you were back on leave. So what happened once you got back?
We went out a few times, and a few times I said, let's get married. She said, not yet. I said, okay. I said, because I'm still in the service, and I got to get a job and doing it. Once I get a job, I'll ask you again. And I went for about 6 months, and I said, are you ready now? And she says, yep.
And that was 71 years ago.
Yeah.
So what's the secret to being married for 71 years and still getting along?
Two words. I'm not a comic. Yes, dear.
How long did it take you to figure that out, though?
Immediately.
Well, and, you know, with regard to what you did in the war, again, this was a real unique duty that you had, that very few people had in the war, that very few people knew about, that would lead to so much more now. You paved the way for the SEALs of today. Yeah. Are there other things you look back on and you say, you know, that was really dangerous, or that could have been it for me, or that was a really unique thing to be doing?
You know, it was really a unique thing. But when you're that age, you are, on your mind is, not me, I'm indestructible. And I spoke to a lot of young guys who felt the same way. They may have changed when the first time that they went into combat. They say, you know, maybe I'm wrong. This is not you're not playing a game.
And on June 6th, half of your group goes to Omaha Beach, the other half goes to Utah Beach. And I think you said there are about 24 that were killed in Omaha Beach and 3 at Utah Beach, including one standing right next to you. How often over the years have you thought about the guys who didn't get to come home like you did, who didn't get to get married and have a family and have the career?
I would say for the first 10, 12 years, I there wasn't a month that went by where I didn't have some sort of nightmare.
Did you lose anyone that was that you were particularly close to?
He was a Marine. We grew up together. He was killed on Iwo. And after being wounded, he went back again. And we grew up together, went to school together.
What was his name?
Hoffman.
Well, and one of the reasons I ask is I know that not only are you going to be honored by the French consulate here on the 75th anniversary of D-Day, but you're also going to be taking a trip with Honor Flight Southern Nevada to Washington, D.C., to the National World War II Memorial. And there they have a wall of gold stars, and it signifies 406,000 Americans who died in World War II. What do you think is going to be on your mind when you look at that?
It's going to take me back. It's going to take me back. I'll be sad. I'll be happy that I was there looking at them. I'll be praying for their souls. I'm not an overly religious person, but I believe in God.
Well, and in light of that, are there things you look at, parts of your story, decisions that were made, being in the right place at the right time, being knocked out but not killed? Are there moments, maybe different from that, that you look at and you say, well, that God I believe in was looking out for me?
Yeah, I believe in faith. I really do. You know, I'll say, I always believed. I said, it wasn't my time. I could say that I'm not religious, but to a point, I probably am. And it wasn't my time.
And for the guys who didn't get to make it back, who are honored there in Washington, D.C., who are in your memories, your friend Hoffman you just told me about, who died at Iwo Jima, how should those Americans be remembered all these years later? What's the significance of their sacrifice?
No, that's a part of history that should never, ever, ever be forgotten. And they should always be remembered. Of course, most of them were very, very young men.
And you're done with the war. You and Selma get married. Here you are still married 71 years later. You had a couple kids, 4 grandkids, 8 great-grandkids. And you said growing up you had thought about being an engineer. When you got out of the service, you wanted to work for the NYPD. Is that true?
Yes, yes. In the worst way, I said, I know all about it. I'm good with guns. I'm good with this, that. But it was, I never realized you had to be a certain height. And I said, I was good enough to be in combat, but I'm not good enough to be in the police force. And when I seen this relative of mine, 5'3", and she gets in, as soon as she graduated, this is in New York, she went ahead and captured a guy. Her partner was on the other side of the street. At that time, they wore big, long coats. And with all the equipment, she couldn't get her radio out. And she tackled a guy that was 6 foot tall. Wow. Tackled him. He robbed the store. She tackled him and handcuffed him. And she couldn't get her radio to call her partner to come across the street.
So she's 5'3", and she's with the NYPD now. But back then,
Just retired.
Yeah. But they told you you're too short?
Yep.
So what'd you end up doing?
I went to the fire department to see if I could get it. They said, no, you got to be a fireman, period. I said, no. They would have taken me, but I'm fiercely afraid of fire.
You ended up being a paramedic?
Yeah, 15 years, and I was an instructor at a medical school, Albert Einstein Medical School, teaching emergency medicine to second-year students who wanted to work on a, you know, in an emergency room when they were off. It's a different kind of medicine.
And when you moved here to Las Vegas, you decided you wanted to be a part of the police department here?
Yeah, I wanted to do everything that I could. I volunteered for security force here. I volunteered with the police department. That's it. I used to do handicap parking, and I gave it up because you went from an air-conditioned car outside to write a ticket back into the air-conditioned car. I ended up one cold after another. Then I heard about the McCarran Airport. So I went ahead and I tried for that. They said, sure, we'll be glad to have you. So I've been there 12 years. I pick my days, I pick my hours, I do any one of them.
And what do you do?
I help people out, keep my eyes and ears open. Of course, it's a dangerous time, unfortunately. And anything suspicious, we don't go after somebody. We take our radio. Within a minute, we got a policeman coming down, armed policeman. We're not supposed to. We follow somebody, but never get close enough for them to see you're following them.
Well, I'd say tell us what days you work and where in the airport you are, but I don't want someone distracting you from that job because that sounds like you have to be pretty alert.
Yeah, we are. We are, you know. I stay in the baggage. I used to be all around, but now I stay in the baggage department, keep an eye out. Stolen luggage is the biggest thing.
How can you tell?
They're suspicious looking, but you can't go over and say, all you do is you pick up somebody looks a little suspicious, say, by the way, can I see your luggage tag? Because all luggage looks alike. I want to see if this matches. You're very, very calm and nicely and respectful.
How long are you going to keep doing that?
My captain said, you're the oldest one here, and you're the oldest one driving the car. And I wish some of my policemen would drive as good as you.
So you don't have any plans to cut that out?
No plans. As long as I could walk, and I don't stand still, I'm constantly walking. I start in the morning, 5-6 hours later, I sit down for lunch. I don't want to get up. But otherwise, I'm on my feet all the time. I clock myself and sort of do about 10 miles a day.
Well, I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you, but I don't want to forget either to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us a story that only you could tell us. Is there something you'd say as you approach that 93rd birthday that you're most proud of or you're most thankful for?
My family, my children, my grandchildren. I'm blessed. I have nothing else. You know, I have everything. I'm healthy. I don't want to be a burden to anybody. We're active. My wife and I are active. My wife was a walker with me, but you see, she has a walker. She fell cleaning the refrigerator, and the floor is slippery. She fell back and busted her back on her birthday, June 24th. So she's been on a walk, and she hates it. She walks around the house without it, but she hates it because she misses walking. We used to walk a mile, 2 miles every day. We're very fortunate.
Is there anything I didn't ask you about that you think we ought to know or understand?
No, I'm thankful. I'm very, very thankful.
And of course, we are thankful for the privilege of spending this hour with Jerry Deitch. Such a treat to meet his wife of 71 years, Selma, as well. You'll find their wedding photo online at hometownheroesradio.com. And as a postscript, you heard Jerry mention the incident off of Hokkaido when the ammunition blew up and wounded an officer who was the brother of Football Hall of Famer Otto Graham. As Jerry said, Otto was in college for most of the war. He was a football and basketball star at Northwestern. Otto Graham entered the Navy's V-5 program and trained as a pilot. And later on, Graham would become the football coach and eventually athletic director at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy. As for his brother, Vic Graham, he did survive that incident that Jerry recalled. Vic went on to marry and have 3 children. He watched many of his brother's championship games in person, and he passed away in 1998 at the age of 75. Jerry Deitch is looking forward to his 93rd birthday this April, so if you happen to see him around baggage claim at the McCarran International Airport, say hello and thank him for serving our country. That's all the time we have today, but thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.